From Maine Public Radio and mainepublic.org, I'm Ari Snyder with the news on this day in Maine, Thursday, May 15th, 2025. Central Maine Power Company's corporate parent intends to preserve almost 80 square miles of forest in western Maine. The proposed easement is required by permits for Avangrid's controversial transmission line connecting Quebec hydropower to the New England grid. Peter McGuire has more.
The plan would encourage mature tree growth, protect wildlife habitat, and shelter streams that support cold water fisheries, says Avangrid spokesperson John Breed.
It is also adjacent to other contiguously conserved lands in western Maine, creating an area of around 450,000 acres of conserved land.
The parcel near Jackman is bisected by Route 201 and lies near Avangrid's New England Clean Energy Connect transmission line. Land conservation was required for state approval of the project, which was embroiled in years of legal and political battles. If approved by state regulators, the Maine Bureau of Parks and Lands would hold the permanent easement. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Peter McGuire.
The University of Maine Advanced Structures and Composite Center is laying off 9 employees amid cuts to federal funding. Maddie Smith has more.
Engineers, scientists, and technicians are among those who will be laid off, effective June 6th. The center currently employs almost 400 workers, roughly half of whom are students. The vast majority of its budget comes from federal grants and contracts, supporting work in energy independence, advanced manufacturing, and civil infrastructure. In April, the U.S. Department of Energy suspended awards totaling almost $16 million, and others have been delayed during the federal transition. According to a university statement, the layoffs were necessitated by the pause in funding. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Maddie Smith.
Hannah Pingree, a former Speaker of the Maine House of Representatives and rumored gubernatorial candidate, announced today that she's stepping down from her role in the Mills administration. Pingree has led the governor's Office of Policy, Innovation, and the Future since 2019. During that time, she's helped lead Governor Janet Mills' initiatives on climate change, affordable housing, and workforce development. Her last day is Friday. Pingree, the daughter of Democratic Congresswoman Shelley Pingree, is frequently mentioned as a possible candidate to replace Mills when the governor is termed out of office next year. If she decides to run, Pingree would join a field of Democrats that already includes Secretary of State Shenna Bellows, former Senate President Troy Jackson, and Angus King III, the son of independent U.S. Senator Angus King. A Kennebunk physician found guilty of unlawfully distributing controlled substances will not serve prison time. In a hearing in U.S. District Court in Portland today, Dr. Meredith Norris was sentenced to 3 years of probation. Her attorney, Tim Zerillo, says that's the sentence he and his client had asked for. Zerillo says Norris treated marginalized patients experiencing both pain and addiction, and her actions were intended to help their complex needs.
In our view, at least, there was some cherry-picking by the government of some very discreet prescriptions that they found to be outside of the normal course of a professional medical practice.
Norris must also perform 600 hours of community service. Zerillo says she no longer has a DEA license to prescribe controlled substances. St. Mary's Regional Medical Center in Lewiston is withdrawing its lawsuit against the federal government in a dispute over pandemic relief funds. Patty White reports.
St. Mary's sued the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services in January after the agency withheld Medicare and other payments. The government claimed that the hospital had failed to file timely reports on its use of more than $5 million in pandemic relief funds. St. Mary's acknowledged that the reports were filed late, but argued that the funds weren't misused. Hospital officials also said at the time that they only had 10 days of cash on hand. Shortly after, the government resumed payments while the case was litigated. St. Mary's filed a motion to dismiss its lawsuit earlier this month. The hospital's attorney says the case has been settled and the government is making payments. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
The Bangor Housing Authority plans to bring 30 apartments to the city along with support services to people with a history of chronic homelessness. The project is one of 5 approved recently through the state's Home for Good program. The others are in Auburn, Augusta, Sanford, and Portland. The nonprofit Preble Street will provide 24/7 support services for residents on site. Bangor Housing Executive Director Mike Myatt says the project is the first of its kind for the city.
Most recently, the largest encampment in Bangor was closed, and many of those folks were rehoused. But we know that without some level of supportive services, a continuing level of supportive services, those folks may be at risk to become unhoused again.
Myatt says the goal is to start construction on the apartments next year and have residents move in by 2027. EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin testified today that the agency removed maximum contaminant levels of four PFAS chemicals because there was a procedural error in how the standards were set and that they could be restored in the future. Zeldin appeared before the House Appropriations Committee, where Maine Congresswoman Shelley Pingree questioned him about the agency's PFAS standards. Pingree also pressed Zeldin on canceled PFAS research grants for the University of Maine and the Central Aroostook Soil and Water Conservation District.
Since these grants are consistent with the EPA's priorities, do you know why they were terminated?
Zeldin says he agrees that the research is important and implied that the grants could move forward under a different office in the future. Since President Trump took office in January, environmental information, including climate-related data, has been scrubbed from some federal agency websites. While scientists and policymakers are concerned about disappearing data, it also disrupts teachers' lesson planning. But as Molly Anking reports, there are efforts to ensure educators have the tools they need to continue teaching students about climate change.
Are you getting the fish now?
Oh, I got one.
How?
Wait, you actually got one?
Oh, wait, I got one too.
Are you going to be able to see that?
All right, everybody, I'm going to need you in your seats.
In Ruth Poland's College Environmental Science class at Mount Desert Island High School, students are creating eco columns in plastic bottles that mimic nutrient cycling in the natural world.
Okay, so here is the document you're going to be filling out. Please read it. It's most.
So far this year, Poland and her students have covered earth sciences, ecology, and will soon move on to a unit on energy.
We'll look at the energy infrastructure map and note, like, where are all of these things in Maine and then in the country? What are the patterns of these different resources?
But when she reviewed her upcoming lesson plans, she ran into a snag. The U.S. Department of Energy website that previously linked to a tool to calculate energy usage by state instead contains a page about energy dominance.
This is the energy infrastructure map. But there's stuff missing, like they won't have the carbon emissions associated with those anymore, that sort of stuff. And I'm worried that this won't be available into the future.
What Poland has witnessed is something many science educators experienced during Trump's first term, when the Environmental Protection Agency began deleting web pages and data en masse.
Yes, there are a lot of resources that are being taken down and data that's being taken away on federal sites.
Margaret Wang is executive director of Subject to Climate, a national educational nonprofit that prepares ready-made lesson plans for teachers on climate change. A former teacher herself, Wang says she knows how sudden roadblocks to information can be extremely frustrating for busy educators.
You have so little time to grade all these papers, lesson plan, and do all these things, so that if you're going back to a site where you used to have maybe a lesson plan or data that you would refer to and it's not there anymore, that might be the point where you decide, you know what, I'm going to, you know, either do another quick Google search or I'm just not going to teach about it.
Subject to Climate uses software to detect broken links, so Wang's team can monitor sample lesson plans to see when data have vanished. She says, while the nonprofit's resource database has been affected, there are still plenty of lesson plans still intact for teachers to use.
We have to push through this moment in time because this is a tipping point and we need everybody, all hands on board, for climate action.
One of the first online climate resources to be scrubbed by the Trump administration in 2025 was the Environmental Justice Screening Tool. Lourdes Vera, an assistant professor of environmental science at University of Buffalo, had used it in her college-level classes to illustrate the correlation between asthma rates and marginalized communities.
So I might show this tool right next to a redlining map, and students can very, very easily see and visualize the correlation between asthma rates and whether a neighborhood was historically redlined.
But now, there's a copy of the removed screening tool available online, thanks in part to a collaborative called the Public Environmental Data Partners. It's one of several environmental organizations established during the first Trump administration to monitor and archive federal environmental resources and data. Vera, who works with one of the organizations in the collaborative, says so far they've rebuilt 6 of the online climate tools that had been removed.
During the first Trump administration, we really could build that infrastructure and create those lists of URLs to track and so on. So, you know, we're not starting from scratch now. We've been building this for 8 years.
Organizations working on tracking and rebuilding online climate resources are known to some educators. And Margaret Wang says word is spreading.
I've seen a movement. Educators have been emailing me and saying that, hey, I noticed that the EJ, the Environmental Justice Screener tool, is no longer there. There's other organizations that are saving it. So here's a link to it. And I think there's an informal group of people that are starting to address these gaps.
Given the strides being made in preserving government data and resources, Wang is hopeful climate education will endure.
I painted you a story of a teacher that may no longer teach about it because it's not there, but I also painted a story of another teacher that will find it because there are indeed a lot of nonprofits working together to try to make it accessible, not to just teachers, but the whole public.
Mount Desert Island High School teacher Ruth Poland is optimistic that climate education won't go away because, she says, there's a real appetite for it.
Students ask to learn about climate change. There's a lot of climate anxiety among young people. It's an area of broad interest because they know that they're going to have to deal with it. And they're curious about what's going on. They want to know the truth.
But Poland wonders what will happen in a few years when the archived data no longer reflect the latest science and the EPA isn't updating these tools. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Molly Enking.
Every 18 minutes, someone accidentally kills another person, with a car, a gun, or by making an error on the job. When we read or hear about the victims of these tragedies, we have empathy for them and for their loved ones. But do we feel the same about the person who contributed to the unintentional death? It's a question that a Yarmouth woman is exploring after her husband was killed in an accident at work 5 years ago. Susan Sharon has more.
Karen McKenna recalls the driveway moment she had while listening to NPR in 2023. What caught her attention was an obituary about Marianne Gray, an educator and social psychologist who decades earlier struck and killed an 8-year-old boy when he darted in front of her car on a rural road.
I was not driving recklessly, and Brian was just being an exuberant kid. Although the justice system absolved me of any legal responsibility, I blame myself for his death. For 25 years, I've thought of Brian every day.
That's Gray reading from a letter that she shared with NPR in 2003. Gray spoke about holding herself accountable while also learning to forgive herself. She embraced compassion and became an advocate for those who cause unintentional harm. She also created a website for what she called the club nobody wants to belong to.
Lawyers advise us not to talk, and most of us feel too guilty to ask for help. We hide in our homes and grieve.
Some people engage in self-blame and self-harm, but with therapy, others are able to find peace. And all of this resonates with Karen McKenna. 5 years ago, her husband James was killed in a workplace accident. She describes him as a sweet, funny, unassuming guy who loved art history, surfing, and hanging out in the backyard with her and their 2 sons.
It was a traumatic loss. You know, a perfectly healthy man went to work and didn't come home. He had plans for that evening and the next day and, you know, the next 20 years together.
Under the terms of a legal settlement, McKenna is unable to discuss details of what happened to James. She says after her initial shock and grief, her thoughts turned to her husband's coworker, who made a mistake that day on the job. He's a young father, and McKenna says she hopes he's cared for and that he knows there are thousands of other people in his shoes.
I just don't think it's necessary for people to suffer, you know, when this is something that often is completely unavoidable.
Marianne Gray shared that view. Before her death, she'd been working on a handbook for survivors in collaboration with an Episcopal priest. The NPR obituary mentioned that the book titled Accidental Killing would be coming out in 2024. So Karen McKenna made a note to herself to get her hands on a copy. It was published late last year.
So this is the book itself.
Oh, terrific. Yes, I'm so glad you brought it. Thank you.
Recently, Karen McKenna delivered a copy to the Yarmouth Library and to the library in the town where her husband died. She's determined to raise awareness for people who may not know where to turn.
Really, there's nothing like this in our collection. That's why I was so excited when you first talked about bringing it here and would we accept it.
The book contains tips, exercises, and prompts for discussion and self-reflection. Reverend Chris Yaw is its co-author, who met Marianne Gray after he unintentionally caused someone's death. She invited him to write for her blog. He encouraged her to start a foundation. Yaw says they became good friends. And then he pitched her the idea of co-writing the handbook.
There are a lot of memoirs out there. There are a lot of chapters of books that talk about this, but there's not a handbook for somebody who's been through this or for somebody whose loved one has been through this, and to explain and unpack what it's like to go through this. So she said, great idea, and we both started writing it.
Gray died of complications from a medical procedure before the book was published. But before her death, she and Yaw also created the Hyacinth Fellowship, a support group for people who have unintentionally killed or seriously injured others.
We try to point our fellowship members to directions of helping others. Very often we find a cessation or at least a decrease in our own pain when we can help other people.
In Greek mythology, the hyacinth is a flower that bloomed after a Spartan prince was accidentally killed by the god Apollo. Among other things, it's a symbol of transformation. And that's one of the takeaway messages of the book, that it is possible to recover. For McKenna, losing James has been beyond description. But she says being both compassionate and forgiving feels like the right thing to do, and the best way to honor the memory of her late husband. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Susan Sharon.
And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org. Coming up on Maine Calling at 11 tomorrow morning, Maine Counties. I'm Ari Snyder. Thanks for listening.